This free program is paid for by the listeners of Redwood Community Radio. If you're not already a member, please think of joining us. Thank you.
By Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Good afternoon, everybody. You are tuned to Redwood Community Radio. This is KMUD Garberville, 91.1 FM, KMUE Eureka Arcata, 88.3 FM, KLAI Laytonville, 90.3 FM, and in Shelter Cove on our translator, and that frequency is 99.5. You can also find us on the web at KMUD.org. It is 1:30. It's 64 degrees outside our KMUD studio. We will be going to Sunday Talk here in just a minute. I'd like to let you know that Sunday Talk today will be hosted by Willow Rain, and we'll be hearing a discussion on peak oil, corporate personhood, and the transition towns model. So stay tuned.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this month's Open Forum. My name is Willow, and I'm your host for the next hour and a half. I have three segments, three different half hours here, with different guests in each half hour. The first segment, we're going to be talking with Gail Darrell, who is a community organizer for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. That's at celdf.org. And so Gail is on the line right now. She is the New England community organizer, like I said, for the CELDF, C-E-L-D-F. And she sent me this brief bio that I'm just going to read word for word because it encapsulates so much. So she writes, "For over 20 years, my husband and I have lived in Barnstead, New Hampshire, on a small homestead, gardening on rocky but productive soil, surrounded by forests and abandoned hay fields near the Suncook River, rebuilding pianos and other musical instruments and homeschooling our four children, who are now all adults. In 2005, I got involved with a small group of townspeople who wanted to create a local law to protect our water. I first learned about the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund when we began researching ordinances passed at the local level. Thomas Lindsay, L-I-N-Z-E-Y, Thomas Lindsay, Executive Director of the Legal Defense Fund, came to Barnstead at the invitation of our select men that year in October, and for the next 3 months I was the coordinator between the select men and the Legal Defense Fund for the drafting of our water ordinance. That was in 2005. In 2006, Barnstead became the first municipality in the country to strip corporate constitutional privileges as a way to ban water withdrawals, with the adoption of the Barnstead Water Rights and Local Self-Government Ordinance, which was enacted by a town meeting vote of 135-1. I began working for the Environmental Legal Defense Fund in 2007 and have worked with the towns of Nottingham and Atkinson in New Hampshire and Shapley, Newfield and Munro in Maine to adopt similar ordinances. I'm currently on staff at the Legal Defense Fund as a community organizer working with folks across New England to adopt local laws that assert the unalienable right to local self-government. So welcome to KMUD Redwood Community Radio, Gail Darrell.
Thank you so much, Willow.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you on the air finally after our several wonderful conversations that we've had. So why don't you just fill in a little more of the detail? I just used your bio there to give the broad sketch of who you are and what you do. But talk about what you did there in Barnstead, and then, you know, we can elaborate that into more in general about what the Environmental Legal Defense Fund is doing.
Sure. I basically was hiding in my garden for over 30 years because I knew there was a problem. I didn't have the words to articulate that problem until I attended my first democracy school, which is a program run by the Legal Defense Fund. I also didn't have a strategy on ways to fix that problem, which I now have. So those are two important things that I learned in 2006, just before we passed our local ordinance here in Barnstead, New Hampshire. So I was hiding in my garden and looked around at me at some important things that were happening, one being a corporate water withdrawal in a couple towns over. The folks didn't want it, and they put up a really good fight. But in the end, the court ruled that none of their concerns, the community's concerns, really mattered. What mattered was the corporation had the permit, had followed the application correctly, filled in all the blanks correctly, and we're now going to be in their community withdrawing over 350,000 gallons of water a day.
Mm.
So in Barnstead, that was really close to us, and we said, we want to do something to protect our water. And we've watched Nottingham do a really good job and in the end fail. So what are we going to do differently? There was a small group of people, some members of the Green Party, some local progressives, a couple liberals thrown in, and a couple conservatives who all worked together around this one main issue, which was water's a human right and we need to protect it. So early on we began looking around us, and a young activist, Olivia Zink, told us about Democracy School and the Legal Defense Fund. And so we started taking a look at their website and at some of the things they'd written, and we decided that this was a really good way to go. And so we talked to our selectmen and had them invite Tom Lindsay here to give us his Pennsylvania story. After a big potluck dinner, I brought vegetable soup and homemade bread down to the town hall and invited people in to hear what Tom Lindsay had to say, and it was a really good evening. My very first in Barnstead, where everybody kind of gathered around a common goal. There was a lot of division in the town. There still is some of that. But water was important enough for everybody to be on one side. So that's how I got involved. And what we did was work with Tom Lindsay to create the ordinance that suited us. And when it was all written, we went back and forth with the selectmen. They brought it to the lawyer, who, of course, you know, said the things that we knew he was going to say about it. And the selectmen just realized, well, you know, that's your opinion. We appreciate you giving that opinion, but we're going to try something new in Barnstead, and we think we have the rights available to us. We can exercise those rights and accomplish something real.
Wow. So can you just give a little bit of a filling out on there? What does the legal opposition say when you bring this kind of thinking to bear?
Well, the ordinances are built in such a way that we use this expression, we run at the truck. We run at all the problems that are going to hit you head on when you try to do something in your town that goes against regulatory law, settled law, and even environmental laws. And certainly the big issue here in a small community is corporate assumed privileges. I know they're called corporate rights. I tend to not put those two words together. I don't think they have rights. I think they've been able to claim rights, but I don't think they're theirs. So for me, they're assumed privileges, and they've been granted those assumed privileges to exercise authority that really belongs to the people who live in the community. So three things that our ordinances do, they strip those constitutional privileges at the local level. They assert the right to local self-government, which we all believe we have. So that's nothing new for our ears. We remember learning about that, you know, the Revolutionary War and all of that struggle that we came through, the abolitionist movement, certainly that language of rights is in that. Civil rights, labor rights, it's all very familiar to us. So we decided to exercise those rights. The other thing we assert in the community is the rights of nature, because quite frankly, if you only view nature as the value you get from destroying it, so in other words, you come into this piece of property, you might mine the groundwater and sell that in little plastic bottles, or you could dig out the gravel pit and chop it up into little pieces and sell that by the truckload, but to just value nature as it is, for a beautiful piece of land that you can grow food on, that you can draw the water that you need from, so you can sustain life, that's a whole different interpretation, perception. And the ordinances do that. We assert the rights of nature, stripping those away from corporations and applying them to nature as an ecosystem, puts the community in a better balance, because now you have a platform to stand on to have your argument.
Yeah, basically, which is another profound mind shift, along with so many others that are involved in this particular approach, the shift from seeing nature as resources to being something that has rights in and of itself. That right there is an enormous change, given the way our society and our economies have been structured for these many centuries, especially the imperial attitude.
It goes back a really long time.
Yes,
and yet I'm living in a community of mostly conservative voters. And to be able to come into a room and explain to them what that meant, you know, rights of nature, that it's a way where the community can assert rights and also protect land that, you know, for instance, I might not own the entire river, but in the town of Barnstead, if that river, if I see that river being destroyed, I can stand in the shoes of that river and say, nature's not protected here, and I'm pointing it out. And so I have legal standing to go to court and argue for not only the cessation of whatever activity is polluting that river, but then to also bring claims for it to be restored.
And has that rights of nature approach been contested in court ever?
No, and it's interesting, not in New Hampshire. None of the ordinances have yet to be challenged in New Hampshire. And it's interesting when you look at the question of why. We have some opinions on why we think that hasn't happened. But challenges have been brought in other parts of the country. For instance, in Pennsylvania, where we've been passing these local laws for quite a bit longer. Early on, it was having to do with like factory farms that would come into a community where family farmers were trying to survive and create all kinds of pollution. The local farm families needed a way to assert their own protections for their health, safety, and welfare, and found that when corporate rights were thrown into the mix of the argument, they didn't have enough money to fight for those, what we call unalienable rights. So they needed a different mechanism. And the ordinances, as well as giving them that legal mechanism, it's also an organizing strategy. So you can claim the rights. You can stand on the foundations, the early fundamentals of government. And you can also level the playing field by the way the ordinances are written to give you that space you know, normally if we're talking about property, as we were referencing a little while ago, you have to have a financial interest in the property in order to protect it. You have to own it or abut the property, some documentation in law that says you have a financial interest. When you take a property out from under that structure, people might argue, oh, well, now it's not worth as much, you know, as it used to be, because now, you know, I can't sell it because it's under these other protections.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it opens up communities to now create the sustainable places that we all want the earth
right.
to be.
Boy, there's a whole program right there about conservation easements and the whole market, free market
yes.
ethos brought against resources there. So I just want to shift very slightly, I suppose. I don't know. I just had this one of our conversations. You clarified something for me that corporate personhood is not the only element in this picture, that there have, well, like you say, rights in quotation marks relative to contracts and the whole commerce clause in the Constitution. So could you just fill that out for our listeners about that personhood, contracts, and commerce are actually a fuller picture?
That's right. In other words, if you look in the words of the Constitution, the First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments are within our Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly when we read the Constitution, there's no word corporation in there.
Uh-huh, right.
But when
yes.
you see the rights that they also have rights under the 14th Amendment. But only some of those reference the word person.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them reference not the word person, but say that Congress can make no law. So it's talking about commerce.
Uh-huh.
Congress can make no law, nor state shall make no law, that impairs the obligation of contracts or that interferes with the regulation of trade or commerce.
Mm-hmm.
So you have those two pieces that are in the Constitution, that corporations have gained protections under those clauses.
Yes.
The Contracts Clause is Article 1, Section 10, and that was more or less decided in the Dartmouth College case. And if you look at that whole court decision, and I won't take time to explain the whole thing,
uh-huh.
but eventually what it did was it said that you can't interfere with a contract. So in other words, say a mining corporation comes into your town and they have a contract on land that they've either purchased or leased.
Mm-hmm.
For you to say you can't take that coal out from under my home because my property's subsiding, that corporation says, well, that's my property, and I have a contract to take it out.
So
now you're interfering with my rights.
And so how does the ordinance that you, the ordinances overcome that? Can you spell that out a little bit?
Sure. When we strip corporate rights within the town, we strip all of those, not just the ones that pertain to the word person, like the First Amendment right.
Mm-hmm.
That appeals directly to freedom of speech and a person speaking. And this whole discussion, for instance, around Citizens United, it was actually something that came up much before the Citizens United case. The Citizens United case affirmed a former decision.
Uh-huh.
But that was in the First National Bank versus Bilotti, and that was back in 1978, where money was viewed as speech. So you can't deny a person the right to speak. So corporations don't have mouths, but they do speak, and they speak with money.
Mm-hmm.
So in denying them the right to apply money, you know, to, for instance, put up advertising for something that's not directly with their businesses organized, chartered to do,
mm-hmm.
You're violating their right to speak. So when the Citizens United case came out, that nullified laws that were on the books in like 20 states.
Hmm.
But it wasn't the first time that corporations had that First Amendment right. So the ordinances strip away all of that.
All of it. So I'm going to interrupt you there for a moment to say to our listeners that the lines are now open for you to call in with comments or questions for Gail on this topic of corporate rights. Is that how we talk about it? Then the number to call is 707-923-3911 or 800-KMUD-RAD, which is 800-568-3723. So Come back to that. Glory be. I just lost where we were. Do you know where you were just now before I interrupted you?
Yes, we were talking about that it's not just the issue of personhood. That's only part of the problem because corporations have more rights than would be covered by that.
Uh-huh.
And we certainly don't believe that would eliminate the problem of corporations coming into your community. Uh-huh. And imposing all kinds of restrictions that you try to place on them.
Okay, well, we do have one caller, so you're on the air, caller.
Hi, great show. This Citizens Untied case, that's what I call it.
United?
Kind of what it is. Citizens Untied, it comes from a long precedent aspect of a case out here in California, actually. I think it was Southern Pacific Railroad, but it was a railroad company in the Bay Area, south of the Bay Area. And it started this whole corporate personhood fraud. But back to your main topic, I wanted to ask if there's any kind of law or investigation that may be going into public nuisance. Because if somebody creates a public nuisance that affects a general area of a community, that's considered to be not only a civil matter, but also criminal in the elements of taking of property, causing danger to people. And I would just like your take on dealing with some of these issues as possibly in the public nuisance area of law. Thank you very much for all you do and for this show.
Yeah, thanks. Great question. Yeah, so Gail, can you pick up and run with that? Is that within your powers?
Actually, that's a really good question, but it's not one that I can take up. I'm not familiar with any cases right now that are handling the public nuisance laws. My stuff's more about, you know, environmental obstructions that people are causing in a community. I'm certain sure that it could be followed along the same framework,
mm-hmm.
but I just don't happen to have any knowledge in my area in New England where that's happening.
Do you have any resources or links that come to mind immediately that the caller could pursue in that regard?
For public nuisance law?
Yeah.
Gee, I don't know. It's not anything in my realm.
Okay.
Of the Legal Defense Fund. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the Legal Defense Fund for a moment. It's a fund. So can you talk a little bit about what money, where it comes from, how it's structured? That's always a big question when someone's doing righteous work. Where's the money coming from? So could you talk about that a little bit?
Certainly. About half of our funding comes from just small funders, people who send in, you know, $25 or $50. Just to keep us going and keep the work going.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these are folks we've met at presentations or from the communities where we work or just, you know, at general meetings where we're joining with other folks to present a message. And the other half comes from funders, just like any other nonprofit. We're a public service nonprofit law firm, so we have to fill out grants and apply for money from foundations just like normal nonprofits would, and we have someone on staff who's responsible for doing that. That would be our associate director.
I see. So how many people in the country are there who are like you, community organizers? What's the network that the Environmental Legal Defense Fund has set up for you to operate within?
We're a very small group, and I'm really happy to say that this past summer we've added another organizer in New England. Chad Nicholson came to join me in New England to assist in Maine. It's really nice to have him on board. And we've also added Kai Hushka, who's out in the west part of the country, working out of Spokane, Washington, that area. So we've added a couple more organizers on there. We have Ben Price, who does Pennsylvania, and he's assisted by Shireen Parsons, who came out from Virginia. Shireen was living in Virginia, and she's come on to assist Ben in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And then Stacey Schmader holds everyone together. She's our national director of democracy schools. So she keeps everybody on track and connected.
Okay.
And then, as I said, Thomas Lindsay is the executive director, and then Mari Margill is our associate director.
So let's talk a little bit about democracy schools. That was where you first came and became familiar with the Legal Defense Fund, right?
That's right.
What are these? Talk about those a little bit.
Well, as I said, I spent 30 years recognizing that we had a problem, but democracy school gave me the language
mm-hmm.
so that I could articulate exactly what the problem is. And they also gave me a strategy so I could do something about it.
And the strategies, there's these ordinances.
That's right.
Okay.
It's the organizing part of the ordinance, which is all of the education about how we got here
mm-hmm.
and the legal structure behind it, and that it's nothing new. I mean, good heavens, there have been corporations, you know, since very early on in our history, and the East India Company, you know, was a really good example of
mm-hmm.
of a setup like that. So,
because mm-hmm. The early colonies were all crown corporations, or most of them, right?
I mean, that's correct.
The corporation structure. I mean, talk about corporate personhood. It used to be embedded in the monarch. So it goes back a long way in that regard. So the democracy schools then, do they occur only where CELDEF has an office like yours, or can they occur like somewhere like here? Could I get in touch and say, hey, I want a democracy school? How does that happen in a local community?
You certainly could. You could call up Stacey Schmader and just talk about the concerns in your community and how you think the democracy school would help you just sort of frame the issue. It's a Friday night and Saturday,
uh-huh.
and we spend that time educating the community where people really want to, you know, get serious, get around their kitchen tables, draft a local law that makes sense for whatever the issue is, because as we say, it's not the single issue. The real problem here is that all these single issues are symptoms of what we call the real disease, which is that we can't make decisions about things that affect us in our communities.
Right.
And so to have that self-determination, those are the steps you go through Friday night and Saturday, where we unravel history and then stitch it together again. We also have a one-day school
mm-hmm.
that's what we call is just a community school. People are just curious. They just want to get their feet wet. And we also have it online as well. If you go to our website, there's Democracy School online.
Cool. I'm going to interrupt you there because we do have another caller.
I kind of want to interrupt you, too. We had another caller who was wanting to know some of the language on the ordinances because they weren't totally understanding that. And then, yes, we do have a caller on the line, and I want to remind everybody we've only got a few minutes before the top
right.
of the hour where I have to pull away.
So let's take the caller quickly, and then we'll get back to the language on the ordinance. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, quickly, about the ordinance, Willow, great idea to rescind the corporate rights. How are you going to overcome the appeal court saying it's unconstitutional?
All right, well, let's put that to Gail in a moment. And we'll get to the language of the ordinance, which might, in fact, answer that question. So, Gail, go ahead with the language specifically. See if you can clarify that a little bit.
The language specifically stands in the foundation of fundamental law, so it would be the state constitution. And what it says is, as we do have the inalienable right to govern ourselves, because government originates in the people, and most of our original documents have that language in them. We don't have to create the language because it's all there. And what we stand on is we have the right to that inalienable self-government. So in order to claim it, you need to exercise it. And in order to exercise it, much as the abolitionists did, you might have to contradict some things that we understand that might preempt that thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And really, when you go through democracy school, one of the things we talk about is the most difficult piece is not that the state will preempt you, not that corporations have rights. The biggest problem, the obstacle, is your cultural training and what's between your own two ears.
Oh, uh-huh, uh-huh.
So, well, we have to segue on out of here from you. The clock has ticked around, and we're going to let you go. People could go to the celdf.org website and get a whole load of information about ordinances and language as well. So, Gail, thank you so much for coming on the air here. This conversation, obviously, is a deep one and will continue much further. So we'll say fare thee well to you, and maybe you'll call back in the final segment when we're talking about the transition towns model. That would be good to hear from you in that regard. So let's segue on to the next piece now. And first of all, though, I need to do a station identification.
I actually have some underwriting, too, so if I can just take it away from you for a moment, Willow, that would
cool.
be great.
Oh, that's good. Yes, thank you. Underwriters are very important.
All right, we do have, I agree, underwriters are very important, and we have two wonderful that I would like to let you know about. Support for KMUD comes in part from Arcata TV. Have you heard about ArcataTV.com? It's a local TV online featuring music, art, politics, sports, and more. You can also upload your own video, audio, or images to share online at ArcataTV.com. Also, KMUD thanks ShopSmart and Redway for their support of your community radio station. ShopSmart featuring an expanded selection of organic and natural items with a homegrown employee atmosphere and service. Open year-round from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. It is 2 o'clock. It's 64 degrees outside our KMUD studio today. You are tuned to Redwood Community Radio, KMUD Garberville, 91.1 FM, KMUE Eureka Arcata, 88.3 FM, KLAI Laytonville, 90.3 FM, and on our FM translator in Shelter Cove, that frequency is 99.5. We're also streaming and archiving 24/7 on the web, and that's at KMUD.org. This coming hour of programming comes to us in part from Hagedone Directories, Inc., publishers of the Black Book Phone Directory. The Black Book is now green. Their directories are 100% recycled from cover to cover, printed using non-hazardous solutions, glues, and soy-based inks. Online at blackphonebook.com. Reduce, reuse, and recycle. You are tuned to Sunday Talk, hosted by Willow Rain, and let's go back to that in just a second.
Hello and welcome back to the Sunday afternoon talk show, Open Forum. My name is Willow Rain, and our next guest for this half hour will be Mark Rabinowitz, who is calling in from Eugene, Oregon. Mark is author of the forthcoming book, Peak Choice, Cooperation or Collapse, which looks at the choice for civilization. Will we use the remaining fossil fuels to relocalize everywhere, or will we continue to pursue endless growth on a round, finite planet? And his website is www.peakchoice.org. So welcome to KMUD Community Radio, Mark Rabinowitz.
Yes, hi. Am I on the air?
Yes, you're on the air. Hello, Mark.
Hello to you.
I'm so pleased to have you here, especially after what we just learned from Gail there. Your book is upcoming, and I've looked at the table of contents, and I would like to go through some of those items with you during the course of this interview here. But first of all, I would just like to hand it all over to you and have you start talking about your book, Peak Choice, and what's breaking loose for you right now in terms of your understanding. You've got this book that you've all written. Your mind must be full to overflowing. And What's breaking loose for you now that that's all down on paper and other things are happening?
Well, I think to really get started here, a lot of the book is about energy and energy choices. And I think the most important thing for us all to think about in terms of energy right now is the meltdown at Fukushima in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
We need to really honor the workers at that facility who are trying to mitigate the meltdown there as best as possible and are sacrificing themselves in their lives in order to try to keep the rest of Japan habitable and the Northern Hemisphere from being polluted.
Mm-hmm.
So we really need to honor their sacrifice and see it as a warning for civilization that we need to shift course if we're going to survive. And we all know this. And this is not an issue of politics or philosophy. This is an issue of survival of the species and survival of all species. You know, redwood trees are just as vulnerable to ionizing radiation as human beings. And we have, you know, if you think about the biosphere of the planet, it is just this thin little film just a few miles across. It's less than the distance between Arcata and Eureka, the breathable part of the atmosphere. And we are all at the point where we have more energy consumption now than we ever will have, both in terms of oil and coal and natural gas and electricity and nuclear power. And how do we use this wisely in the decades to come as the concentrated energy runs down? And these are the biggest questions. They're even bigger, I would respectfully suggest, than the issue of corporate power. You know, Chernobyl was not caused by corporations. The Fukushima disaster was. But even if we had the end of corporate power and Dennis Kucinich became president, or we had Ecotopia, or whatever other sort of utopia you would like to see, we're still going to have this incredible legacy of digging up the fossil fuels and the long-lived nuclear waste that is the biggest challenge in our species history.
Hmm. Yeah. So in our conversations before we came onto the air here, you were talking about the billboards in Tokyo being shut down, the electricity, and then rolling blackouts and brownouts, and you were calling that peak electricity. Can you just go into that a little bit about, just fill that out, what that means, that it's peaked?
Well, I assume a lot of KMUD listeners are familiar with the concept of peak oil,
mm-hmm.
which does not mean that we are running out of oil or have run out of oil, but it means that we've reached the limits to growth of how much oil can be run through the system. And this is imposed more by nature than by politics or economics. There's only so much oil that can be dug out of the ground at such a fast rate, just like we've had peak forests in the redwoods. You know, the concentrated old-growth forests were liquidated much faster than they could grow back, as
mm-hmm.
I'm sure KMUD listeners know.
Right.
Electricity is more complicated because electricity is very hard to store in a large quantity. In the United States, about half of our electricity is from coal, and coal probably has not peaked, but it is close to peak,
mm-hmm.
which is why we're going after mountaintop removal in Appalachia and other very destructive practices. Nuclear power has probably now peaked. It's not just that uranium is finite, but after the disaster of Fukushima becomes really apparent, it's clear a bunch of reactors all over the world are going to get shut down, including probably some here. And in California, you have Diablo Canyon sitting on an earthquake fault south
mm-hmm.
of the Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
which is a faulty idea, of course. And natural gas, which generates about as much electricity in the United States as nuclear power, it peaked in its production in 1973, almost 40 years ago. That was the motivation behind the liquid natural gas import terminal proposed for Humboldt Bay a few years ago, which the citizens there managed to successfully stop because of the enormous dangers of having LNG terminals, which are basically a big bomb, sitting there in the harbor blocking access for the fishermen and posing risks to the town of Eureka. So all of these together are either at or near their peak of production. There's also an enormous economic fallout we're going to see from the disaster in Japan in terms of the factories being taken offline that are critical for the global economy. And you also have the Japanese are going to be trying to desperately get more fossil fuels into their country to replace the nuclear generation that they have now lost permanently to try to stop the rolling blackouts. I would also like to suggest the obvious answer people will then say is, well, what about solar and wind? And I'm in favor of solar and wind. I've been using solar power for 21 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful. But
mm-hmm.
it's probably not going to be possible to replace all of the electricity that we use with renewable energy.
Right.
And this is a whole very long and convoluted topic in itself. But the bottom line is we've waited too long, and solar has a lifetime of another billion years, as far as we know. But it's also difficult to concentrate. And if we had made the shifts decades ago, we would be a lot further along than we are now. It takes fossil fuels to make solar panels and wind turbines and to move them around, especially wind turbines with all the concrete
right.
and steel.
Which comes to the point I've heard you make several times, that we're at a juncture here, in the peak choice of, do we use the remaining oil to make solar panels and turbines or battleships and weapons? And I'd just like to segue into what this chapter that you've got in your book here, renewable energy could only power a steady state economy. So could you fill that notion out a little bit, what a steady state economy looks like as opposed to, you know, what we've got now?
Well, a good analogy for a steady-state economy would be an old-growth forest. And the way an old-growth forest is defined is it's not just about having large trees. It's where you have growth and decay in balance. So you have the very big trees, and they're growing, but you also have the former trees quietly rotting into the soil for the next generation. And when you look at the Earth as a complete system, it's finite. You know, once people thought the Earth was flat, and then they thought the Earth was round, but our economic system assumes that the Earth is constantly getting bigger.
Hmm.
Our monetary system requires endless growth on a finite planet, and that worked well for a while, but it can't work anymore, and that is essentially the root cause of the financial meltdown that we're having. It's not only corruption and corporate power and greed, although those are certainly factors. But even without corporate power and greed, you know, we have reached the limits to growth on a finite planet, and that ultimately is even more important than the corporate power problem.
Okay, and in your book you have a whole section called Peak Money, and you've got a chapter called Energy Creates Money, Not the Other Way Around. So could we just take this riff that we're on and go into that this financial collapse is not just about money. Of course it's not. It's about energy, because we have a thermodynamic economy. So can you fill out what your thinking is on that, that energy creates money, not the other way around?
Well, this is a... Probably the best way to think about it is the concept of the hierarchy of needs from the psychologist Maslow.
Mm-hmm.
And we need air and water and food, but money is symbolic. And it is created in our monetary system by loaning it into existence through debt and compound interest. And it's a remarkable exchange mechanism. But it's probably not a coincidence that the financial crash of 2008 was triggered around the time that the oil spiked to $147 a barrel,
right.
Which also came around the time of the all-time peak of production of liquid fuels on planet Earth.
Hmm.
And these are very complicated interconnections, and it would be an oversimplification to say peak oil caused the economic crash, but it was certainly a core factor behind it. So if we're going to print more money or make more digital money, that does not automatically increase the amount of available resources. For example, think of the people in Japan who are living in the basically refugee shelters, either because their community was destroyed in the disaster or their having to flee from the radioactive fallout. They need physical resources. If you were to give them a big pile of money, that would be nice, but if the resources are not physically there for them to use, that's not going to help them.
Right.
Can you talk in that regard? Just pick up that notion and talk about community currency, where when you do have a localized sense of where your resources come from and such, that how would a local currency be different? Can you talk about that?
Well, the concept of a community currency, the most famous one in the United States is called Ithaca Towers in New York State, and there's a couple ways that they can be structured, but the bottom line is it's setting up a parallel monetary system where people can make a exchange for their labor. Some of them do it on an hour-to-hour basis. There's other ways to do it as well. These are wonderful ideas, but they're sort of a sideshow, even when they're done well. As the economy continues to oscillate and ultimately contract, we're going to need to implement them on a large scale, decentralized in many different places. But having them be a very tiny percent of a community's currency is not going to be sufficient if you have a larger financial instability.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there are any in your listening area, but there's a couple of them in Oregon. Mm-hmm. But even in the communities that have them, they're not a very large part of the local economy yet. But perhaps some of them are making good practice for when they're going to be needed even more.
Yeah. Yes, we do have a couple of systems here. So I just want to take all of that thinking and move into your section in your book called Peak Scenarios. And if you would, just talk a little bit about, we talked about this earlier, about Wall-E world, and then segue from that into your notions on permaculture for 9 billion people, a permatopia. But your take on Wall-E was pretty interesting, and we'll open up the phone lines in a minute, but you can keep on talking. We'll get some callers.
Well, Wall-E, of course, is the Disney Pixar movie set 700 years in the future after Earth is too polluted, presumably from nuclear waste, for humans to survive. And the survivors live on a spaceship, which is a giant shopping mall, and they've gotten fat and lazy because they don't have to do anything, and everything is attended to them by robots. But the moral of the story at the end of the film is don't fantasize about living in a shopping mall. We're going to have to go back to the Earth and learn how to grow food if you want to eat pizza, which is a great message for eight-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the symbolism here is that our culture, I think a lot of people are fantasizing that the future is about going to live on a base on Mars. And then the truth is we're going to have to learn how to grow food again and relocalize food production, even if we have the best possible outcome in terms of a renewable energy society. There's still 7 billion of us, and we're all going to have to share the planet together.
Right, which brings us to the permaculture for 7, 8, 9 billion people, what you call permatopia, the growing of food. And I just need to remind our listeners who you are, Mark. This is Mark Rabinowitz, who is the author of the upcoming book, Peak Choice, Cooperation or Collapse. So now the phone lines are open if you want to call in with comments or questions, and Mark and I will continue this walk down the list of top topics that he's got in his remarkable book that's coming out soon. When is it coming out, Mark?
Hopefully by this summer.
Oh, cool. We'll look out for it. Will you do a book tour? Will we be able to see you?
Probably, but I don't have details on that now.
Okay. And I also need to give out the phone number. The phone numbers to call are 707-923-3911 or 800-KMUD-RAD, which translates as 800-568-3723. So, Mark, yes, just continue talking here about your images of permaculture for 9 billion people, what you call permatopia. What's that image in your mind?
Well, we have tremendous talents that we have created through industrial civilization. But unfortunately, you know, it's not news for your listeners that most of our federal research and development money goes towards perfecting more weapons of war, as if we haven't figured out how to perfect them already. we have technologies of global domination and destruction, but there's very little efforts with all this incredible intelligence and resources for acting as if we are planning to stay here on planet Earth. We're going to have to relocalize food production as the cheap energy goes away, because if people have to drive less, some people will welcome it and some people won't. But eating less is going to be more difficult. For example, you have the disruption to Highway 101 in your neighborhood right now with the landslide that caused by a clear-cut sliding onto the road. But this impacts the delivery of food to the people in your community. And the logistics that are required to constantly keep food and other resources always appearing in stores, that requires a constant supply of cheap energy. And if the cheap energy is going to be replaced by more difficult energy, we're going to have to focus incredibly on relocalization of food. Not just having a couple farmers markets or a couple backyard gardens, but enough for people to have their basic needs met in their communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a very sophisticated food localization effort going on here in Humboldt County, even to the extent that someone has done the work to figure out how many acres we need to add of food production in order for everybody in Humboldt County to have, I think it's a 2,500 calorie diet per day, to see if in fact we can even do that. So the localization of food here, we get local food weeks and lots of posters around. So there's a pretty high degree of awareness around here about local food. But the point you're making is well taken. You know, that we've got the widening of Richardson Grove to bring bigger trucks in, and all of that is resonating with why don't we do it by sea. So every time you touch this issue of localization, it touches so many other enormous questions.
Well, and in Eugene, Oregon, we have a pretty extensive food relocalization effort as well, but we only grow about 5% of our food here in the Willamette Valley. We import most of our basic staples from other places.
Wow.
And I'm not talking about tropical treats like coffee or strawberries in January or anything like that, but just the basic beans and grains, meat, cooking oils,
right.
You know, lovely salad at the farmer's market or a couple of backyard gardens are all very nice, but that's only a small step of what's going to be needed.
Okay, we've got two callers, one of whom is Gail. So let's have Gail on. Is she? Can we have Gail on first? Okay, here's Gail.
Hi.
And then we'll have another caller. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Willow. I really appreciate the topic of conversation here, and I want to thank Mark for all his work on this. And just to say that those local sustainable energy policies is another thing that we've looked at, and I really, you know, applaud your efforts and want to tell you that I think we're really all on the same page here, and that's an important step. So thank you again.
All right. Thank you, Gail. That was Gail Darrell, who was our guest in the first segment. And we have another caller. Yes? Yes, there's another caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I'm looking forward to your book. Yeah, the whole issue with the Federal Reserve, whose motto, I guess, is all the money that's fit to print, basically is a vast pyramid scheme that makes Bernie Madoff look puny. And there's a secret code on the back of each dollar bill, which is a pyramid winking at you. Not so subtle. I wanted to bring up, go into the aspect of the issues on how bad the system is, as you outlined in Wall-E and the future nuclear nightmare that we're looking at here, now breathing. Public Law 102-486, 102nd Congress, and it's all about, well, it's all 486ing us. Through the U.S. Enrichment Corporation. 102-486, I found it in a law library. You can probably find it online at this point. It goes into the U.S. Energy Reenactment Policy, but in the middle of that, it authorizes the creation of the U.S. Enrichment Corporation. It was brought about in 92, 93 when George W. Bush, Papa Bush, was leaving office, and this was his exit strategy and farewell gift to all of us, I guess. The mission of these folks is to market and sell as much enriched uranium to persons domestic and foreign. foreign, thereby justifying the DOD and defense budget so they can fight what they put out on the game board, so to speak. And the most outrageous aspect was to make as much money as possible for the U.S. Treasury. So when did they, you know, get authorized to go out and sell nuclear Girl Scout cookies to us to raise funds? I mean, it's just outrageous. And no offense to Girl Scouts. I appreciate those wonderful cookies.
Good image.
Anyway, I'd like to hear your comments on that, and I would suggest you might take a look at that and maybe include it in your book, because it really is the answer to what fuels this whole nuclear nightmare and pyramid scheme that we've been forced to live under. Thank you again.
Thank you, caller. So, Mark, can you pick up on any of that?
I'll try. The U.S. Enrichment Corporation was set up to create new ways to make nuclear fuel for nuclear power, and they built a facility in New Mexico, and I'm not sure if it's opened yet or if it's about to open, but either way, it's basically built. It's been a while since I've looked at it. One thing people don't realize, when Obama and other nuclear promoters say nuclear power is carbon-free electricity, well, it takes an enormous amount of energy input to make the whole nuclear fuel cycle, from mining the uranium to processing it. Enrichment is very energy intensive. It takes a lot of coal power to make enriched uranium. And in the long run, how much energy is it going to take to babysit all that nuclear waste essentially forever? How much energy is it going to take to deal with the meltdowns, and they are meltdowns, at Fukushima?
Mm-hmm.
It's beyond calculation. No one can really give a, you know, how do we guard waste that's toxic longer than industrial civilization has been around? And nobody has an answer for that.
Right.
But I would suggest part of the future is going to be nuclear babysitters. We're going to need to use some of the remaining concentrated energy to stabilize and store the very long-lived hazardous waste so that our great-great-great-great-grandchildren are not poisoned by it. As for the Federal Reserve, that's a whole topic in itself, but the Federal Reserve is certainly part of the problem, but even if the Federal Reserve was abolished, we still have the basic problem that the economy as a totality has reached the limits to growth. And we need to combine concern about the pyramid scheme, the Ponzi scheme of the Federal Reserve and similar entities, with the realization of steady state economics is more appropriate for being on a finite planet.
And so to bring all of that together, just talk briefly, have about a minute left here on this segment. Your section in the book called Omni-Spirituality, can you just pull all everything you just said about these mega problems? What's Omni-Spirituality?
Well, in summary, the biggest consciousness shift that we've had as a species, probably in the entire history of the species, was seeing the Earth floating out there in space. And we are very good at both cooperation and competition as a species. But the paradigm shift is we're going to have to see our tribe as not the people who look like us or talk like us or live in the same village, but live on the same planet. And this is being born right now, but it's kind of a rough birth, and we've got a lot of birthing pains going on in civilization. And I'm convinced that part of the problem is confusing religion and all the stories around religion with identity and cultural identity. And the more that we see that these are just different flavors and they don't change the underlying reality underneath, the more likely it is that we can evolve to adulthood as a civilization.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, we're going to let you go so we can go into our third segment. Thank you so much, Mark. It's been wonderful having you on the air, and we'll certainly look out for your book, and hopefully everything will go smoothly in that production and distribution effort for you. And maybe we'll have you back on the air another time to talk further about, I mean, everything you said is as a whole show in and of itself. So thank you so much, and do feel free to call back in the call-in segment of a call-in time section of the next segment. You may have something to just add or comment on about the next part. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. So now I need to say that you're tuned to Redwood Community Radio, KMUD Garberville 91.1 FM, and we are bringing online the last two guests who are going to take up the last half hour here. Chris Dwyer in Boulder, Colorado, and Dan Schwab in Richmond, California. I'm just looking.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's been wonderful. And we'll.
All right, we got to get Chris to turn down.
Okay.
Okay.
What's happening here?
I've got Chris on the line, but he's got to just back off on the.
That was his.
That's
online
his on
thing
Skype.
On.
Yeah.
I see. His feedback.
Chris, can you hear us?
I can.
Okay.
Oh, all right. Very cool.
Okay,
so,
still.
Okay, Chris. Yeah, we're still getting a feedback.
Section of the next segment.
Yeah, Chris was listening online with Skype, and so there's a delay. So what he was listening to was not real time. So, Chris, do we have you there now?
Say that you're tuned to Redwood Community.
No, not yet. We're still playing out his machine. So I'll just continue to talk here then. Chris is going to be coming in on Skype from... he lives in Colorado and is involved with the Transition Town model there, which is online at transitioncolorado.org. And he was a guest on the show that I hosted in February for the Women's Radio collectively. And he's currently focusing on the Local Food and Farm Enterprise Fund. So I'll be sure and ask him about what that is. And the other guest that I'm going to be bringing on this next segment until the end of the show will be Dan Schwab, who's also involved with Transition Towns. And he lives in Richmond, California here. And their initiative is accessed at Richmond Rivets, R-I-V-E-T-S, richmondrivets.org. Dan and I were among the 35 people who attended a training for Transition Weekend in Sonoma in January, and Dan makes his living as a leadership consultant. His website is danschwabconsulting.com, Dan Schwab, S-C-H-W-A-B, danschwabconsulting.com, and he talks about himself as guiding transformation leader by leader. So Chris and Dan, do we have you both on the air now?
This is Dan. I'm here.
Yeah. Hi, Dan. Have we got Chris on Skype?
I'm with you.
Oh, hey, both of you. Great. All right. The engineer smiles and puts her thumbs up. So both of you have been listening to the earlier segments of the show. So what I would like to do, if I can get my ducks in a row now, is just start off with reading this piece, which comes from the Transition Movement mothership website here in the United States, transitionus.org. And it's about the transition movement definition, they say. The transition movement is a set of inspiring ideas for creating an attractive and enticing vision of how our community can be The converging crises of climate change, peak oil, depletion of nature, and economic instability cannot be solved separately, which is what Mark and Gail were both saying. They cannot be solved with technological miracles, but only by lessening our dependence on fossil fuels. This doesn't mean a bleaker future. The heart of transition is the belief that if we engage with enough imagination and ingenuity to unlock the collective genius of our communities, we can choose a future that is more satisfying, just, and resilient than what we have now. So that, in a nutshell, is what the transition movement is about, and you are both involved in it. So, Chris, why don't you go first and just say a little bit about who you are and what you're doing and touch in on your local food and farm enterprise fund.
Sure, Willa, thank you. Well, I should say that I come to the transition movement. I've been involved with it for about a year now. And I came from a very, in some ways, traditional kind of approach. I was a professional university fundraiser, and before that I was a federal grant maker. And so one of the things that interested me about the transition movement was how we do money in this country. And I really appreciated Mark Rabinowitz's comments about peak money and how that's connected to peak oil, peak electricity, and other phenomenon. I really also want to reference Gail's comments related to community organizing, and set transitions somewhat apart from community organizing, though doing transition work really does not preclude one from doing community organizing. As your definition from Transition US stated, this is really a proactive movement that we're involved in. It's a kind of personal and community activism blended. And leadership is not really defined in contrast to any organization or to fight any particular corporation or government entity, although it does seem that sometimes those entities take the wrong steps based on our societal challenges. But it's really more to create a groundswell within a community that does support the vision that Transition US referenced there. In terms of my personal engagement, I've really come into transition and really seen that in Boulder, Colorado, where we are, that relocalization of the food system is indeed an imperative. Echoing what Mark said about where he lives, we spend a little bit under $1 billion annually on food in Boulder County, and we actually only purchase, as far as we can tell from the available data, less than 2% of that from local farms. So what we have is a rather upside down situation in terms of our abilities, community's ability to be self-reliant, to support ourselves, and to provide healthy food to people of lower income groups. So we're working on that in a variety of ways. We're getting our community engaged. We're raising awareness, and we're also working in the world of money that I referenced before to start a fund that will actually invest in local food and farming enterprises.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yeah, it does. Thank you. And Dan, just say a little bit about who you are and Richmond Rivets, and just build us a picture of how that all goes together for you.
Well, sure. Thanks, Willow, and thanks for having me on the show. Richmond's an interesting place. It's a city of 100,000 that's between Marin County and Berkeley, but a world apart from either of them. Richmond was the center of heavy industry for most of its career, including the world's largest shipyard during World War II, where the phrase Rosie the Riveter came from. And we are also the home to one of the largest oil refineries in the state of California, the Chevron Refinery, that's been here since 1904. So there's a lot of very interesting issues here as we look at, well, what's the potential future for the city of Richmond? The question I like to ask to help people think about this, because we have been very poorly trained overall to think about the future, is to ask people, well, what's it going to be like to live in Richmond 50 years from now? Where will the food come from? How will we get around? What's the demographics of the community likely to look like? What migratory birds will still come through here? Those kinds of questions. And that sort of perspective, granted, a very large-scale perspective, but that kind of provocative question is what got me into the transition movement. I've been an environmental-type person for a very long time, but the transition movement really struck me for a number of reasons. First, because it directly addresses that question, what will it be like here in the future, but in a way that's positive. And as Chris said, and as all of our speakers have said, it's about creating a positive image of the future, one that's based more on hope, possibility, and action than it is talking about all the things that could go wrong or what happens when there's no more oil and, oh, my God, we can't just drive our cars around whenever we want, you know, that fear-based reality. So Richmond Rivets is a relatively new organization, like Chris's organization, about a year old. And what we see ourselves is more of a hub or clearinghouse for a lot of other nonprofits here in Richmond. There are about 160 nonprofit organizations in Richmond, most of which deal with crime and poverty-related issues. Richmond is actually a very stressed community economically. Again, very different from Berkeley. 5 miles away, but a world apart. And at this point, what we'd like to do with the rivets, and we use the expression the Richmond rivets because this was a shipbuilding center before,
right.
And the rivets are what held the ships together.
Right.
We see ourselves as
holding it
sort
together.
Of that. to help people just get this whole idea of relocalizing in their minds as a possibility and then see what they can do with it. And we're hoping to attract a lot of people to this idea over the next few years. I think there's lots of reasons to think we can.
Right. And so but what both of you have been talking about, and this is the underlying theme of this show, which I haven't touched on very much, but it's been there anyway, is this notion of leadership. What is it? Where does it come from? What does it look like? Who's doing it? And if you're going to have an enticing vision, it means that leadership is basically stepping out into thin air, because there isn't a problem to go combat. There's this thing to invent. So, and I know, Chris, you have a lot to say about leadership as well. So why don't the two of you just share your notions here with our listening audience, and the phone lines will open up for people to call in a little while. In the meantime, we're talking with Chris Dwyer from Transition Colorado and Dan Schwab from Transition Richmond, which is the Richmond Rivets. So,
Dan, would you like to kick us off?
Well, sure. One of the things, since I have the very interesting perspective on this, because leadership is what I teach. I've been in the human resource field for a long time. I've done a lot of adult education, mostly in corporate and nonprofit sectors. And leadership is a topic I teach now. I have a very interesting job. But what I find over and over again is how hard it is for people to recognize that they have the power to envision what could be. We might have 1,100 master's level management programs in the U.S., and indeed we do, but we have we've done a very poor job of helping people understand that we actually do have the ability to look ahead, ask what can be, and then communicate that to other people. And that's, I think, where this fits with the transition movement and many other things, is we're trying to create a society that will be worth living in, probably, after most of us will be gone. And how do we get people to think that way, to recognize they have that power, and not think of leadership as being connected to authority?
Uh-huh.
That's a myth.
Uh-huh.
What do you think, Chris?
Chris, why do you pick up on that?
That's a great point, Dan. I think when we in the transition movement or elsewhere and encounter people and ask them about what their vision is for the community, oftentimes we get a bit of a blank stare. Because it is true that oftentimes in our families and our educational experiences, all up and down the line, the question really never gets asked. There isn't a course on vision. There isn't a course on what you'd want to have happen. There are what oftentimes seem like individual competing ambitions or possibilities. Mm-hmm. And there's not a language really around it. At the same time, there are people in academia and elsewhere who are encouraging more thought along these lines. I'm thinking of a colleague of mine at Webster University in St. Louis, where I worked for a decade, who coined this phrase, lead from where you are. And I think when we talk about transition, or where we talk about just being a citizen or resident of any locale, that's what we really have to acknowledge, is that one, we don't know the future. Two, a vision is very powerful. And three, what Dan is saying about not looking to some other authority to come up with the vision and to take action is really important. We disempower ourselves in a way when we look to President Obama or your local mayor to do the work. The work is really done in some ways at an individual and family level. And what transition really promises, I think, is and delivers on in terms of the skill set is helping people understand how to do this work in community. Hmm. And the action that needs to be taken is not the traditional heavy-handed leader's work, but really one of visioning together and acting in small ways, incremental steps, to test that vision, to probe that vision.
Hmm. Dad.
Well, I think that's right, Chris. And one thing that I try to help people understand is the word vision can be very loaded or misleading. And people think that vision has to be global or huge, like I envision a world where there is no poverty. Well, of course that's powerful, and of course we should be thinking that way. Mm-hmm. But we're not very powerful against a vision that big. So therefore, I like to use the expression small v vision, little v, of, well, what's the possibility I see for what it could be like on my street or in my neighborhood? Something where I have much more likelihood of influencing people to actually do something, to bring that into fruition. And the one of the great things about the transition movement is that it's very decentralized, and the idea really is to get lots of people doing that, thinking about, well, what could it be like in our community, my little part of it, and then to hook up, share ideas, and help make things happen. So leadership in this sense is a ground level grassroots sort of occupation, and that's part of what makes it seductive and probably dangerous to the status quo. We were never trained to take action in this way, for the most part. You know, we're supposed to wait for someone else to do it for us. Yet, if we line up enough people who are awakened to this idea to envision a future worth creating locally, well, that's when these bigger issues are going to start to look a little more possible to address, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to throw in a couple other words into the mix as possibilities for this emergent kind of leadership. And one of them is being a catalyst. I think when we think of the traditional notion of a leader, and one of the reasons we run from this kind of leadership that we're beginning to talk about is because we think we have to organize it all. We think we have to control it in some way, and if the outcome doesn't go the way we initially thought, it's a failure. And this new kind of leadership we're talking about really recognizes that the power to start something and get others to come on board with it, because what you're offering is compelling, and it's also a very humble kind of leadership because it does not presuppose we know where things are going. In fact, I think probably the lesson of our times at the macro level and at the community level is that we don't know. We don't know where things are heading. We don't know what natural disasters lie in front of us. We don't know what political decisions will be made at various strata of society. We're uncertain about our money system and how that applies to our personal finance. And these are scary things, but they're actually quite exciting as well when we give up on the idea that we have to control where they're going. We simply have to influence where they're going from a place of good intention and community awareness.
And where you're pointing, Chris, I think, is to the notion that the best leaders, the ones we would most likely follow, are also the best servants. That is, thinking not just about, well, what do I get by sticking my neck out on these issues, but rather, you know, how can I help the community? And how can I hook people up? As Mark was saying a little while ago, it's cooperation or collapse. And we can model that cooperation. We can be examples of it by attempting to engage people, especially people who are really different than us, which has been one of the really interesting parts about working in Richmond, which is a true rainbow community. The diversity here is fabulous and stunning. And one of the big lessons I've learned from working in this community is just how much patience it takes and how much self-awareness it takes to actually engage a discussion of the future with people who have a very different background and very different set of interests possibly than I do, and not have them see me in a certain way but see me where I'm really coming from. I think the whole process is very humbling, I would say that, and I actually think that's a good message for us.
So I'm going to interrupt a little bit here and say that the phone lines are now open for the listeners to call in. The numbers are 707-923-3911, or you can call on 1-800-KMUD-RAD, which translates to 800-568-3723. And our guests for the remainder of this show, another 10, 15 minutes or so, are Dan Schwab from Richmond, the Richmond Rivets Transition Initiative, and Chris Dwyer from the Transition Colorado Transition Towns Initiative, and talking about leadership and the Transition Towns model and how that's fostered by that approach. And I just want to interject here another piece from the Transition body of wisdom, I guess it is the cheerful disclaimer, which I just really love it. It's also from transitionus.org. So just in case, this is for all the listeners here, just in case you are under the impression that transition is a process defined by people who have all the answers, you need to be aware of a key fact. We truly don't know if this will work. Transition is a social experiment on a massive scale. We're convinced of this. If we wait for the governments, it's too little too late. If we act as individuals, it'll be too little. But if we act as communities, it might just be enough just in time. Everything that you read on this site, the transitionus.org site, is the result of real work undertaken in the real world with community engagement at its heart. This site, just like the transition model, is brought to you by people who are actively engaged in transition in a community. People who are learning by doing and learning all the time. People who understand that we can't sit back and wait for someone else to do the work. People like you, like us, like everyone listening in. So Chris and Dan, keep on going there. What you're talking about, the heart of the transition movement, which is people moving from their hearts to do something about this world that we live in and learning in real time how to work together and how to grapple with these very, very complex situations. So we may have some callers, but keep going. What you're saying is wonderful.
I'd like to say just a word about listening, which is a bit of a lost art in the United States context, I think. I'm doing work not only in Boulder County, but in Nederland, Colorado, my mountain home, a town of about 1,500 people. And I'm discovering as I go about to town visioning meetings and citizens group meetings, those that are opposing development, nonprofit meetings where boards are coming together to figure out their next step and how to be sustainable, that we're very good actually at articulating what we'd like others to believe, but we're a little less solid on the listening front. And teaching and learning the skill of listening is a powerful tool in understanding what a community's needs are and what aspects of the conversation are not being spoken and what are being spoken about in ways that that require further dialogue and action. So part of transition is really understanding the phenomenon of listening. And I think Dan said it really well when he talked about patience. It's the ability to be a sponge for quite a long time before actually speaking oneself.
Well, I think you're right. I think the number one thing people want in from other people is that they be heard and be understood. So it actually goes beyond listening. It goes to really understanding where another person is standing, where they're coming from. And that is a lifetime skill to learn. We're all really impatient and probably not very good at it. We get caught up in our own bias and our own judgments of other people, I mean, all the time. That's one of the things that's attractive to me about the transition movement, is that it's not just out there in our society. It's also in here inside of me. I also need to make a transition into a, quote, sustainable, unquote, person. I have to become the person that I envision myself to be when I'm most effective, and hasten myself along towards that. And, you know, by making a statement like that, we become models for other people to do the same. And while that might seem very small, it's actually very significant. Chris and I were chatting the other day in preparation for this, and one of the things that came up was this notion that we would like to see many big things happen in the United States that would move us in this direction. But most likely what's going to happen is that we're going to see a very large number of very small things happening. Mm-hmm. And indeed, that's how every social movement pretty much has taken place, is at the grassroots, with many people changing their point of view, changing their habits bit by bit, taking on small actions, creating a small win about something, and then using that as to create momentum towards other small improvements. And The transition movement is local. It's about relocalizing, and it really is about us making 1,000 small changes in our communities, starting today, hopefully.
Well said. And I think it's really important to, on a practical note, for people who are interested in how to make this work in their own community, it's really important to start off by observing how your community functions. What are the relationships like? How do people get around town? And this is really a permaculture principle. It harkens to Rob Hopkins' work. He's the founder of the Transition Movement, for those of you who don't know. And you can learn a lot just by sitting in one place and find out who's going where and who's talking with whom in terms of how that community functions. And I think the second part is to really start, I'll just use my own personal example. Boulder, Colorado is 15 miles and 3,000 feet below Nederland, where I live. And the minute I stopped commuting down there every day for work and got engaged in this community and watched what was going on and started to develop relationships, when I really started to understand Nederland and see a different side. So it takes a commitment to one's own locality to start to amass that knowledge and figure out where the points of interest and, I'll dare say, leverage are.
Yeah, I'd like to just interject here. I'm still looking at Mark's the lineup of chapter headings for his book, and one of them is Fractal Solutions, Local, Bioregional, and Global. And my understanding of fractal would be that the small changes that you make locally actually represent a global change, and that as we shift our own lives as individuals, that has an effect on the local, which impacts the bioregional and the global. So this language of his of fractal solutions, on the one hand, it's a little like, what? On the other hand, it's like a new word we can work with and use it not just metaphorically, but actually, that as I become more local, as I engage with my community, the world thereby has changed. And so then there's another, I'm just so looking forward to Mark's book. It's going to be a real treat. He has another chapter heading called Transition Town and Transition Planet, which I think is, again, the same idea of this fractal thing of what happens in one scale is actually duplicated, replicated, mirrored, reflected, done again in the larger picture. So we're coming down to the last couple of minutes here of airtime completely. So why don't the two of you just have last words, and then we'll be done for this session. I hope to be able to do more programs like this and maybe have you back. So each of you just take a moment now to say your last thoughts here.
Okay, well, I'll volunteer to go first. I really appreciated listening to Mark Rabinowitz earlier, and when I saw the title of his book, Peak Choice, I really cracked up, because, of course, we get presented with peak oil, peak fish, peak whatever all the time these days, and it's mostly it's frightening, and it's a negative thing almost. It's like, okay, well, half the oil is gone. What does that really mean? And it's just sort of almost void looking ahead. Well, what's it going to be like without it? Now, of course, we need to look into that, but that void, and come up with something. But the notion of peak choice makes it a powerful place to stand rather than a place of victimhood. Mm. We do have the best choices we've ever had now. We have more power than we've ever had before, we collectively. Mm. And this is the time for us to step into that. And that's why I just think that's a great title.
Yeah. And as leaders, every single one of us is a leader. So, Chris, your last words.
I would like to echo that and say it's really time for each of us to redefine what leadership means to us and to embody the leader, the inner leader that we want to see in the world and at a community level. And that really is as simple as taking the first step.
Mm-hmm. And I want to tie all of that thinking back into what Gail was talking about democracy schools, where you get a new mindset, new languaging for understanding self-governance. And so this whole thing is a whole piece, which I think we're all going to continue thinking about and reflecting on. And I just want to take this moment here to dedicate this entire show to the people of Japan and the people of the world, that we are sitting at a moment of peak choice, and how do we move forward governing ourselves, not just as jurisdictions, but as individuals in the light of what is breaking loose real time in front of us. So thank you all so very, very much. Look forward to having you back on the air sometime. So I'm Willow Rain. I've been your host for the last, how long have I been on the air? An hour and a half. That's staggering. So I just want to close by giving out my email. If people want to get in touch with me, they can do so. The email I use is resilient2030@yahoo.com. That's resilient2030@yahoo. resilient2030@yahoo.com. And I will make a list of the references that we've made here on this show, and I also have a list of links for elsewhere as well, so you can email me for that. And you can archive this at kma.org. So thank you everybody for listening, and we'll see you on the radio another time, and on we go to the next show.
And support for KMUD comes in part from Hackendog Directories Incorporated, publishers of the Black Book phone directory, which is being distributed throughout Humboldt County. Extra copies are available at local Chamber of Commerce offices. It is just coming up a few seconds from 3 p.m. It's 65 degrees. You're listening to the Voice of the Free. Music and talk that liberate the mind. People-powered radio, KMUD.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of Redwood Community Radio. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of KMUD or renewing if you've already joined. A regular yearly membership is $50, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.